Welcome to Talking Dollars and Cents on TalkZone.com, the show dedicated to all facets of your financial life. Now, here's your host, Bruce McMenemy.
Hey, this is Bruce McMenemy. You're here with Talking Dollars and Cents. Last week, we had a number of emailed questions that some people have followed up on that we'll cover this week. I did want to point out I'm a licensed CPA and a certified fraud examiner, but as is the case, not only with the questions you ask of me or any show, always make sure you consult with your own tax advisor or CPA to make sure that you've covered all the details. Obviously, these questions that I'm covering here are pretty general in nature, and every little detail makes a difference. The facts basically dictate what the answer is, so never take a general response and apply it to your situation. It's for guidance only. Any issues that you want to bring up that are money-related are just fine. If I don't know the answer, I'll try and direct you to who might know the answer. But ordinarily, I usually have a pretty good insight as to a handle on what your question and answer is. All right, with that all being said, let's go to our first question, and it's a follow-up from last week. Last week we had a question about Social Security and when you should take Social Security. Should it be at the earlier age of 62 or the later age, which is known as your full retirement age? Something I should point out, your full retirement age, a lot of people are thinking it's 65, and it isn't for many people today. The retirement age has been scaled depending on your age of birth. If you were born 1943 or after, your retirement date is later than age 65. And like I said, it's scaled. So if you're, for example, if you were born in 1956, your retirement age is age 66 plus 4 months. If you were born in 1957, I believe it's 66 years plus 6 months. So it's scaled. It's not 65 anymore if you were born after 1943. Now, the question that Larry from Tampa sent in says, in your answer about Social Security, many of us want to continue to work part-time or run a small business. It is hard to do because Social Security takes back your benefits if you earn so much money. Is there any way around that? Okay, what Larry's talking to is if you take your Social Security payment early, let's say at age 62, Social Security says, yeah, you can do that if you want, but if you continue to work and you earn above a certain amount, you're going to pay us back $1 of Social Security benefits for every $2 you earn. So, for example, if you earned $30,000, divide that by two is $15,000 worth of Social Security benefits that would have to be returned to Social Security. In a nutshell, it's not something you really want to do. It's not cost beneficial. But the answer to Larry's question is yes, there's a lot of ways around that. And when I say around it, I don't mean illegally. What I'm talking about is a strategy that's legal to enable you to collect Social Security early if that's what makes sense for you. And at the same time, either have a business or earn some extra income, which most of us are probably going to have to do. Social Security today is not going to cover all your expenses and bills in most cases when you retire. Now, how could you do it? Well, in 2014, if you retire, your earnings limit is just over $15,000. I believe it's $15,480 in 2014. What that means is if you earn more than $15,480, you'll have to pay back to Social Security $1 for every $2 above that amount. So if you earned $16,000, means you earned $520 more than you should have, you're going to have to pay back one half of that, or $260, to Social Security. How do you get around that? Well, if you're working on a W-2 basis, in other words, you're working for somebody and you're receiving a W-2, it's tough. There's really not much of a way that you can get above that limit and be on a W-2. What a lot of people do is they basically start a small business. Can be anything, know, landscaping, website services, internet, computer, whatever. They'll run a small business on the side, and they'll use that to supplement their income. But you have the same problem in that you can't earn more than that $15,480 in profit. So something you might be able to do is if your spouse is significantly younger or significantly older and doesn't have that Social Security issue, the spouse owns the business and pays you to work for the business. And as long as you don't make or get paid more than that $15,480, you're fine. Another way to do it, probably a little simpler, is to form a corporation and elect what's called subchapter S status, which basically means your profits are dividends, not subject to Social Security tax. So therefore, in that situation, you could receive much more than $15,480 and not fall into that category. But that all being said, it has to be set up properly. You have to make sure that your wages that you are receiving are reasonable. It gets a little complicated, but not terribly. But you can get around that. And that's the way a lot of people are doing it today, is basically by starting small businesses and earning money, on the side. Okay. That's Larry's question about Social Security. Now we have a question from Danielle. And by the way, if you want to send us a question, you can do that by emailing bruce@talkingdollarsandcents.com. Just give your first name and city. Or if you wish, you can call in on our studio line at 888-GO-FOR-IT. That's 888-GO-FOR-IT. All right, Danielle's email from Tucson. I owe about $9,000 in back taxes. There are companies that advertise that you can pay just pennies on the dollar. Is that true? Well, it's true that they advertise. It's also true that situations where you can pay pennies on the dollars are very, very few and far between. I mean, they have happened. They do occur. A lot of these companies that are unscrupulous will take the aberrant or really outside-the-box solution and basically get you to believe that it applies in all cases, which it certainly doesn't. The IRS is not, they're not stupid. They will look at these, each individual case very carefully and make a determination. How do they go about doing this? Now, in Danielle's case, she owes $9,000 in back taxes. She doesn't say what it's for, which can make a significant difference. If it's income taxes, that's one thing. If it's, for payroll taxes from a business that potentially she ran or is responsible for, that's entirely different. Those are what's referred to as trust fund taxes, and they're subject to what's called the trust fund penalty. And if you don't pay those payroll taxes through your business, as a responsible person, the IRS will put a penalty on you and basically a lien against you, which you really can't negotiate. It's very, very difficult to negotiate those types of penalties. Can be done, but very difficult. In the case of income taxes, which is the most common situation, the IRS will look at your situation. You have to provide them all kinds of financial data. There's all kinds of forms that need to be filled out. And they will make a determination. There's two categories that you can fall into. One is a determination that you don't have the ability to pay. They've looked at your financial situation, and the IRS has said, you know what? This person doesn't have the money. They can't pay. We're never going to be able to collect this amount of money from them. We might as well just make a deal. That's one situation. Second situation, which is not as common, is they look at the situation and say, well, I'm not really sure if this person is liable for this. So why don't we just, in the interest of, for lack of a better term, justice, why don't we come to some kind of resolution, some kind of deal, collect what we can, and let the person move on. This will happen sometimes in what's called injured spouse cases, where you have, you know, two people that are obviously married. One person is responsible for all the finances, many times owns a business. The other spouse really has no idea what's going on, but signs a return. It's a joint return and really doesn't have a clue as to the fact that the taxes aren't being paid. And in that particular case, there's a safe harbor. Or a, I don't want to say a loophole, but a provision in the law that allows the spouse to come forward and say, hey, look, I'm an injured spouse here. I didn't know anything about this. I need to get this resolved. What can we do? So basically, there's two determinations that are going to be made. One, can you pay it? And B, do you actually owe it? Once that determination is made, they'll look at the reasonableness of what your offer is. These are called offers in compromise. And they require you, when you file your application for a compromise, to say, hey, here's how much I have. And this is all under penalty of perjury. You can't lie. Here's what my assets are. Here's what my income is. Here's what I can afford to pay. And based upon that, the IRS will make a determination, what could they collect if they were successful versus what are you offering? And if what you're offering is reasonable, chances are they'll come to some kind of a resolution with you, allow you to pay that amount either in lump sum or over time. The caveat is, in order to do this, you have to make sure, and one of the stipulations that you will agree to in any type of an offer resolution is that you will be current and keep up with paying your income taxes going forward. So this isn't something you can do on a regular basis. It's usually a one-time event. Somebody dies, you lose your job, there's a foreclosure, a whole host of things can happen, a natural disaster, hurricane, flood, fire, you name it. It's not something that can be done on a regular basis. Now, to circle back to Danielle's question, are there companies that do this? And the answer is yes. There are companies who are out there advertising, hey, owe $100,000 in back taxes, we can get you to only pay $500 and you're done. Those are suspect. It really depends on the situation that you're in, and depends on what your assets are. If you're sitting on a house that's worth $250,000 and you own it free and clear, and you say to the IRS, hey, I can't pay you the $10,000 I owe you, that's not going to fly. It's got to be reasonable and pass the reasonable man test. Now, some of these companies have actually been sued, been shut down. There's been a lot of nefarious practices that have gone on where basically they victimize people by saying, well, hey, we'll get you a resolution, pay us $2,500 up front, and then you pay them the $2,500 and nothing ever gets done, and lo and behold, you don't end up with your resolution. So be very careful. If you're going to do an offer in compromise, if I can give you any advice, it's this. Go to somebody that is licensed, be it a CPA, an attorney, somebody that has a license, where if they don't perform, I'm not saying they're successful, because this is up to the IRS. Nobody can guarantee that they'll be successful. But if they don't perform, in other words, they take your money and they don't, contact you afterwards and they don't follow through, you have a place to go back to, which would be the state who licensed these individuals, and you can file a complaint. So that's kind of your leverage to make sure that the individual you're dealing with is somebody that will follow through and is probably reputable. Don't just go by some advertisement you hear on the radio or on the internet or at 3 o'clock in the morning. The world is full of people that have gone down that path and have been basically victimized. So be very careful, Danielle. Good luck with it. All right, I've received a couple emails, actually more than a couple, from last week in regards to Obamacare. Some of them are fairly complex and detailed, but I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk a little bit about Obamacare, also known as the Affordable Care Act, and discuss some of the underlying issues. I think in many cases the rhetoric has basically clouded what's either a good program or a bad program and how it impacts people. You don't have to be a Republican or a Democrat. It's a question of, how do we go forward in this country and take care of health insurance and take care of people and do it in a reasonable fashion. All right, I think what we'll do is we'll go to a break, which is coming up, before I get into the Obamacare issues. And why don't we do that right about now? And I'll see you at the other end of the break.
Welcome back to Talking Dollars and Cents on Talk Zone. Here's Bruce McMenemy.
Okay, we're back. Before the break, I alluded to the fact we're going to talk a little bit about Obamacare, also known as the Affordable Care Act. Like I said, I received a number of email questions last week about Obamacare and what the effect is. Let me read one of the common ones. This email is from John. He didn't list a city. I have a small business, and I am worried about the effect of Obamacare. In my opinion, if people don't have insurance and can't pay, they shouldn't get service. It is no different than if you go to Walmart to buy something and don't have the money. You walk out the same way you walked in, with nothing. Is there any way a small business can opt out or plan to be exempt? Well, obviously, the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare is a topic that's being discussed, you know, nationally right now. It's on a lot of people's minds. There's a lot of, in my opinion, misinformation that's floating around on both sides. Be a Republican, be a Democrat, be a for health care insurance through the government or not. I consider myself pretty conservative. But I've come to the conclusion over the years that something has to be done about health care and insurance. I mean, I see situations on a regular basis. You know, one example I'm thinking of right now is an employer who, you know, provides family coverage for their employees. And the cost of a family plan per month is $2,100. I mean, that's absurd. I mean, $2,100 a month for health insurance. I mean, many people don't even earn $2,100 a month. And here, that's just one facet of your bills you'd have to pay. It's become outrageous. And there's a lot of reasons for it. I don't think any particular sector's to blame. But I think what gets missed in this, and I've had this conversation any number of times with some, you know, conservative friends of mine, and they'll pretty much, like John, say, well, you know, if you want to be responsible for yourself and you want to make a decision that you don't want health insurance for whatever reason, it's not worth it to you, you're not willing to pay the money, you don't think you'll become ill, you don't think it should apply to you, you feel that no one should tell you what to do. Those are all valid concerns, all valid reasons. But it completely ignores the facts. Right now, if you don't have health insurance, if you decide I'm not going to have health insurance, I'm going to live without it, and you show up at the hospital and you're ill, they have to treat you. They can't say, well, gee, John, you know, we know you're having a heart attack, and guess what? You know, you don't have any health insurance, and you don't have any money to give us, so why don't you go out the door? And sorry, it doesn't happen. And the reason for that is there are a number of federal laws that require that a hospital treat you if you show up there. They can't just kick you out in the street. That's a fact. Well, people then turn around and say, well, maybe we shouldn't have those laws. If you decide you don't want to be covered by health insurance, you take that risk. And guess what? If it doesn't work out and you show up at the hospital, you don't get treated. And from a theoretical standpoint, that sounds very, you know, cut and dry. And boy, isn't that simple. But it isn't. And here's the example I usually use. You know, a mom without health insurance shows up with a daughter, you know, 6, 7 years old, maybe has, you know, acute appendicitis or some kind of a situation where she's in tremendous pain, walks into the hospital and says, my daughter is very ill and she needs help. Can you help her? And they said, ma'am, do you have health insurance? Well, no, I decided not to have it. Well, ma'am, you have to take your daughter out of here. Sorry, can't help her. Get lost. It's not going to happen. Whether there's a law or not, it's not going to happen. And when that doesn't happen, and the hospital treats that individual, somebody has to pay the cost. It appears somewhere. It's not free. Even if the hospital can't bill that individual, what they will ultimately do is say, well, that's part of our expenses, and our expenses need to be recovered, and they're going to be recovered through our charges. And in short, what happens, you who have insurance, your premiums end up going up because expenses go up. So you ultimately pay for it indirectly anyway. So it's not a situation where, well, it's a choice of paying or not paying. If people opt out of health insurance, they don't just get sick and die. They do use the system. And as soon as they use the system and they can't pay, everybody pays. And that's the fundamental problem. And I don't care what anybody says. No one's going to take the position of, well, too bad the person has to get sick and die. Everybody, I think, pretty much would agree people are entitled to some kind of health care from a human and a compassion standpoint, irregardless of whatever decision, good or bad, they may have made in regard to their own health insurance. So if you start with that premise, you get back to, well, what are you going to do? Do you require people to have health insurance? And that's what basically Obamacare does. It pretty much says, hey, you have to have a certain amount of health insurance, otherwise you're going to pay a penalty. Is that the way to go? I don't know. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But if you don't require people to do it, there's going to be any number of people that won't do it. I mean, they're going to say, well, gee whiz, you know, I'm fine, I'm not ill, I'm never going to be sick, I'm immortal, you know, nothing's going to happen to me. And then when it does, guess what? You get stuck with the bill. Another part of Obamacare that I think that sticks in people's craw is the fact that people are being canceled now. And I think the president misspoke, obviously, when he said you can whatever plan you have now, if you like it, you can keep it. I think that was a gross overstatement. You know, whether he lied or not, I can't answer. I find it hard to believe he purposely lied. I have a feeling maybe his advisors told him what he wanted to hear and he didn't question it further. But it stands to reason if the Obamacare law basically says every plan has to meet a certain standard, there's obviously plans right now that don't meet that standard. And in order to meet that standard, in other words, to be upgraded, somebody's got to pay the cost. It's not free. So if you have a plan that is substandard, and substandard is defined by whoever's looking at it, if we say that plan is substandard, you can't keep it, you have to go to a better plan, it's obvious that the rates are going to have to go up at some point because it has to be paid for. Now, you know, people will say, well, you know, why should I be required to go to a better plan if I'm happy with the plan I got? Well, you need to circle back to the whole situation where if you have a substandard plan, and let's say for argument's sake, you have a plan that pays, you know, 50% of your costs and maybe 60% or 70% for catastrophic things like, you know, a heart attack or major surgery. When you show up at the hospital and you have to have major surgery and you can't afford it, that 30 or 40% that is not covered by insurance, if you can't afford to pay it, which in many cases is what happens, because we're not talking about, you know, showing up for a hospital stay for, you know, a week or 10 days and you may owe, you know, $4,000 or $5,000 and you can pay it off over time. We're talking about you could potentially owe $100,000. It's such a huge amount of money that you basically, you don't have the ability to pay it. In those situations, who gets stuck with it? Again, like we said before, everybody. You can't pay it. It becomes part of the healthcare system's expenses, which gets spread out into premiums. Everybody pays it. So the idea of making people upgrade their policies, I don't necessarily think is a bad one. Again, the implementation in this situation, not very good, obviously. This really should have been quite a bit vetted and tested way before it was rolled out. Now, can you opt out? Yes and no. Directly, you can't really opt out. The law applies to those it applies to, which is pretty much everybody, and includes small businesses. Are there ways, you know, that you possibly can get around it? Yes, and there are companies that are doing it, with a caveat. Right now, obviously, the implementation of this is very, very fluid. The rules are changing by the day. Each state is different in how they're handling things. My advice would be to not take any firm action or lock yourself into any position or business structure because of Obamacare that may turn out to be exactly the wrong thing when all things are said and done. So you kind of got to play it by ear, take it a step at a time. I think the rhetoric has just gotten, you know, just completely out of hand. in my opinion, and I'll say my humble opinion, what I would have done was I probably would have expanded our Medicare system. Our Medicare system functions pretty well at this point, and Medicare is basically for people that are age 65 and older. Not Medicaid. Medicaid is for people with limited income who are below the age of 65, but Medicare. It functions pretty well. I mean, it's not perfect. There are, you know, problems with it, but the system is up and running. So what we could have done, and maybe we should have done, is expanded the eligibility for people to enter into Medicare. You know, right now the age is 65. Maybe what we should have done is lowered the age all the way down to maybe age 18, and charge a premium, obviously, for being involved in Medicare. Another possibility is the Medicare tax right now is 2.9%, half on the employer, half on the employee, with no real no limit on the income that it's taxed. Maybe that Medicare tax rate has to go up, and then we can use that to fund entry into Medicare. Now the rate would probably have to go up substantially. What I think could be considered is requiring everybody to have catastrophic health insurance, some kind of policy that doesn't cover you if you go to the doctor because you have a cold. It doesn't cover you, you know, if you go and you pick up a prescription that costs $30, but it does cover you if you show up at the hospital and you have, some type of major surgery, you know, a heart attack, a stroke, an appendectomy, those types of things, where you would have some basic coverage. I'm not going to solve the issue, but it's going to be debated back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and I'm sure it'll end up being quite different in the long run than maybe is being proposed now or implemented now. All that being said, I think it's time for a break, and we'll be back in about 90 seconds.
Now, more Talking Dollars and Cents on TalkZone.com. Here's Bruce McMenemy.
Okay, we're back. All right, after the discussion about Obamacare and solving all those issues, let's move on to an email from Lewis in Buffalo. Lewis says, my wife wants to pay to get mortgage insurance to cover her in case I die. Is this insurance worth the amount paid? It's fairly substantial each month. Okay, what is mortgage insurance? Mortgage life insurance is really what it should be called. Excuse me. Mortgage insurance, life insurance, covers the co-mortgagees on a loan. So, for example, if Lewis's wife were to die, the house is paid off. If the mortgage insurance was on the wife and she were to die, it would be paid off. And you could do this jointly. You could have coverage on both. One thing to keep in mind, you know, mortgage insurance is a great thing, except for the fact it's extremely expensive and it's highly profitable for the banks that are selling it. You might pay, and I'm just grabbing a number off the top of my head, you may pay $500 or $600 a year for insurance on a $100,000 mortgage to cover one person. And that person, let's say, is age 25, 28. Basically, what mortgage life insurance is, it's called a decreasing term insurance. It's term life insurance that decreases over time because your mortgage balance goes down over time. So it's not like you're taking insurance and you're getting $100,000 worth of coverage, and over the years your mortgage goes down to 50, and God forbid something were to happen, you're going to get 100. No, you're only going to get the balance of the mortgage. So the value decreases over time. In almost every instance, other than the one exception I'll bring up in a second, you're better off going out and just buying a simple term life insurance policy. You know, somebody age 25, $100,000 term policy, if they're healthy, is probably going to be $100 a year, not, you know, $500 or $600. So keep that in mind. It's not really a from a dollars and cents standpoint, it's not a good investment. Except for the exception. Mortgage life insurance is a group insurance plan, which basically means, in most cases, they don't ask you any health questions. So if you're relatively ill or have health issues, you might want to consider this because you may not be able to go out and get term insurance somewhere because of the health situation. Or if you could, the expense might be in excess of what the mortgage life insurance is. Those situations are pretty rare, pretty few and far between. So in general, I would say mortgage life insurance, don't do it. If you're going to do it, make sure you get it on both spouses or both co-mortgagees. Because in this situation, Lewis from Buffalo, the wife may want to cover him, which is great. I'm just assuming here that he's the breadwinner. God forbid something were to happen to the wife. Lewis is in a situation where if they have children, he's going to have to go out and replace her services, which I can tell you, and any wife or mother will tell you, can't be replaced from a dollars and cents standpoint. Extremely expensive. So Lewis would be in a position of having to pay someone to come in and perform the services the wife did in regards to domestic work. And in that situation, he doesn't want to be paying a mortgage. So if you're going to get mortgage insurance, you should get it on both. Whoever the breadwinner is, or even if there isn't one breadwinner, you're both breadwinners, it's even more important. Another item to look at in terms of mortgage insurance, which is slightly different, is what's referred to as PMI, which is private mortgage insurance. PMI, private mortgage insurance, is usually required when you buy a home and you're putting down less than 20%, and sometimes it could drop as low as 10%. So you're buying a house for $200,000, you're only putting down $5,000, therefore you're basically borrowing the entire amount of the value of the house. Well, in those situations, the mortgage holder wants to be protected against you defaulting. So what they'll do is they'll require you to get PMI insurance, which basically protects the bank should you not pay the mortgage. It'll cover the bank's potential loss. Private mortgage insurance isn't cheap. It's very expensive. But one thing you need to be very careful of and watch, as the value of the house hopefully increases and the mortgage decreases over time as you make your payments, that amount of equity in your home should be increasing. As that increases and you get past a certain point, which is usually 20%, once you reach 20% or more equity in your home, the bank really can't require you to have PMI insurance anymore. And in most cases, you need to go to them and say, hey, I don't need to have this anymore. I have at least 20% equity. Let's drop this policy. Because the PMI insurance doesn't protect you. It only protects them. So if you don't pay for your home, you don't get anything. The bank's protected. So it's something you want to keep an eye on. And if you're in that situation now, make sure you get them to eliminate the insurance. Obviously, in the past, 5 or 6 years, this hasn't really been much of an issue because property values have basically been declining in many parts of the country. But now as the economy is turning around, hopefully, and values start to increase, more and more people will find themselves in situations where they can opt out of the PMI insurance because their equity values have increased. Okay, Lewis, thanks for that question. It was a good one. All right, next we'll move to an email from Charlene in Ocala, Florida. Also a mortgage question. I just got a notice of list pendants about my mortgage. I can't afford the payment anymore, and the mortgage company does not even call me back about help. Can they throw me out now? Okay, she's in Ocala, Florida. Well, the first thing you need to do, Charlene, is to speak to an attorney that handles mortgage defenses. All right, there's a lot of attorneys out there, and attorneys are just like anything else. They're like doctors and accountants and butchers. They're either good or they're bad, and there's a lot of them that are somewhere in between. You want to make sure that you get somebody that does mortgage defense, that is aggressive and wants to protect your interest. Now, a lot of times many people say, well, gee, I'm not paying my mortgage payment, so how could I have a defense? I'm not paying. That's not necessarily true. What a mortgage defense firm will do is they'll sit and they'll look at the mortgage that that you signed. They'll look at the paperwork and the application and the underlying note. They'll look at all the aspects of that mortgage and determine whether all the rules were followed, if there are any laws broken, have all your rights been in place and adhered to, and are there any potential defenses, affirmative or otherwise, that you can mount in a mortgage suit. Now, a list pendants, all right, L-I-S-P-E-N-D-E-N-S, basically all that is a notice to everybody in the world that there's pending litigation, all right? List basically meaning litigation, pendants mean basically meaning pending. It's Latin. It's just a notice. It doesn't mean that you've been sued. It means you're about to be sued if you haven't been. But it doesn't mean you're out of your house. It doesn't mean that you lost. It doesn't mean that the mortgage company won. All it is a notice. That's it. When you're served with the suit, at that point, that starts the clock ticking. You know, you have so many days to answer, and an attorney will help, you know, will help you with that if you're smart. A lot of times what happens is people say, well, I'm not going to pay my mortgage payment because I can't or I don't want to, whatever the reason is. They get served with the lawsuit, and they say, well, I have no defense, so what's the sense of defending myself? That's not necessarily true. That's why I said you really need to speak to a mortgage defense attorney who can basically tell you what your rights are. In many cases, from when you're served with that lawsuit to you're actually forcibly evicted from your home, your home has been sold on the auction block, I've seen cases where that runs upwards of 4 years. I don't think 4 years is normal, but it can run that long. A common case is 1.5, 2 years, 2.5 years. So it's not a situation where you get this list pendants and you need to start packing up your closets because you're going to get thrown out the next day. It doesn't work like that. There's still a due process that has to be adhered to. And one thing to keep in mind, each state is different. The way, all mortgages are filed within a state, and state law, it controls what the process is. Some states it's easier to foreclose. Some states it's harder. It really just depends. That's why it's so important that you sit down and talk to a mortgage defense lawyer. One of the things that they've looked at recently, and there's actually been situations where people have ended up with their home free and clear, is where you've had, dramatic and material violations of the law by the mortgage companies and the banks. You may have heard the term robo-signing, where you've had situations where you have people just basically signing documents, not even looking at them. Maybe they don't even have the authority to sign what they're signing. These are all situations where a mortgage defense attorney can help you. Another situation that's developed, I want to say strategy is probably the right term, that's developed in the past few years, and I'm not saying I necessarily agree with it from a moral standpoint, but from a business standpoint, it's something certainly worth considering, and those are what's referred to as planned foreclosures as a business strategy. You may be in a situation where you're looking at your home strictly from a business standpoint, and saying my home's worth $200,000, but I owe $300,000, and there's no way in the world, given the market and given the area that I live in, that the house anytime in the next 10 years is ever going to get back to that $300,000 level. Well, from a business standpoint and an investment standpoint, you may make a determination that it really just does not pay to stay there anymore. You can't sell it. Because you can't find someone to buy it and get you out of the mortgage hole. Maybe you're not able to do a short sale. The bank isn't helping you. There are people that have gone down the route of basically, planning their foreclosure out. From a business standpoint, I understand it. A moral standpoint, there's a lot of people that don't believe it's moral. They believe when you sign those mortgage papers, you made a commitment, to pay. The bank provided the funds. They adhered to their commitment. And you have a moral obligation to follow through. And that's probably true. But that's also why it's important to make sure you get a mortgage defense attorney to look at your situation to make sure that the bank did follow through with its commitment. People may say, well, you know, it's just technicality. Well, yes, there are technicalities, but that's what the law revolves around many times is technicalities. And to protect yourself and do yourself justice, that's something you really want to look in, you want to look into. Now, Charlene, your question, can they throw you out now? Again, you need to speak to an attorney, but no. Based on the list pendants, they can't throw you out. They haven't gotten a title to the property, and you still have a ways to go. All right. It looks like it's time for to take a break here for a couple minutes. We'll be back, and then we're going to talk to Jones in Springfield.
You're listening to Talking Dollars and Cents on TalkZone.com. Back to Bruce McMenemy.
Okay, we're back. I got an email from Jones in Springfield. No state, but I imagine it's Illinois. Jones says, a friend of mine makes about $25,000 a year and pays no taxes. She gets a refund check each year of about $2,500. How can that be if she paid no taxes? Well, without knowing the specifics, it's hard to say, but I could take a reasonable guess here. And your friend probably qualifies what's referred to as the Earned Income Credit, or EIC. And what the Earned Income Credit is, it's a way in which the government provides funds for lower-income people that are working. It's usually referred to as the working poor. And ordinarily, you need to have a dependent child in order to qualify. So this is a program basically that was started to allow payments to individuals that were taking care of families who just didn't make enough to pay taxes. And actually, the government felt that they should be helped in some way and should receive some kind of a payment. And $2,500 is not uncommon. I've seen these earned income credits go up to, you know, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000. But you have to qualify. It's not free money. It's not, you know, anybody's doing anything wrong. It's a program that's been out there for a number of years. It is a program that gets abused, and rightly so. The IRS has been cracking down quite a bit on the individuals that file returns to claim the earned income credit that don't really qualify. And they're also cracking down on preparers that prepare returns in order for people to get refunds. I mean, there's been any number of cases where you'll see the IRS arrest somebody or charge somebody who, you know, promises people, well, you know, you come to me and I guarantee you're going to get a $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000 refund, and you know, you just pay me $300 for preparing your return. And in those situations, many times what's going on is they're lying and saying you qualify for earned income credit when maybe you really don't. And obviously that's not a good situation to be in, especially if you're the preparer. But as the person who's getting the return done, keep in mind, you know, a lot of times people will go to a tax preparer, be it a CPA, be it an enrolled agent, being somebody else. And think, well, I have somebody else prepare my return. That gets me off the hook. It doesn't. Not at all. You are still responsible for your return. You are still responsible for the facts on that return. And just because somebody else prepared it doesn't get you off the hook or alleviate your responsibility. In those situations, if the IRS were to come back and find that you claimed this credit that you shouldn't have, they're going to hit you for the dollars they paid you back. In addition, they're going to hit you for a ton of penalties. It's not uncommon to have situations where, you know, you owe the IRS $3,000 on some tax, and then you tack on the penalties and the interest, and you're talking about almost double what originally was paid out. And that occurs for a lot of reasons. One, the penalties are very, very stiff and probably should be. And two, usually, you know, these things don't happen right away. They may happen, you know, a couple years after the fact, which means the penalties and the interest has been accruing. So be very careful. But for Jones in Springfield, just the fact that someone is getting a refund and isn't paying anything in, that's not necessarily unusual. It does happen, and there are legitimate reasons for it. Something to be aware of, if you qualify for the earned income credit, you don't have to wait until the end of the year to get a refund. What you can do, and a lot of people don't know this, you can go to your employer and say, hey, look, I'm entitled to this earned income credit based on my income, and you know what my income is because you pay me. I'd like to receive it in advance. And basically what happens in that situation, let's use this person that Jones talked about as an example. Instead of getting $2,500 a year, each week when you got your paycheck, you know, over 50 weeks, let's say, you'd get an extra $50 in your paycheck. So your paycheck would go up $50 a week as opposed to getting a refund check at the end of the year. And the reason the government allows that is, again, this is to help people that, quote unquote, are the working poor. They don't have maybe enough funds to get by. And obviously, if you pay them each week, that's a bigger help than if you just give them a lump sum at the end of the year. And that's referred to as the advanced earned income credit, the advanced earned income credit. And you can go and ask your employer about it. And the employer is not taking anything out of their pocket. They're able to take that $50 a week that they're paying you and deduct it from the taxes they're sending in to the IRS. So it's a win-win for everybody. Okay, let's move along. We got an email from BK in Highlands, Georgia. I moved here from Detroit, and I am worried about my city pension. Can the bankruptcy that is going on cut my pension? Now, there's a lot of people worried about this one. As some of you may be aware, you may not be aware. The city of Detroit filed for bankruptcy protection, which I believe is Chapter 9 under the bankruptcy code. They're by far the largest government municipality that's filed for bankruptcy. And here's the real issue. To answer his question very simply, yes, his pension could be cut. Many municipalities have gotten themselves in a situation where they've promised benefits over the years that they just can't meet. And this has happened primarily because of politics. Now, you're running for office in a city, whether it's Detroit, New York, Chicago, Sacramento, San Francisco, it doesn't really make a difference. You're running for city office, and you need votes. And where do you get votes? Well, one of the places you can get votes is by going to the unions and saying, hey, I want your support. I want you to tell your union members, city workers, to support me and vote for me and tell their friends to vote for me. In exchange for that, I'm going to be very open to a very generous wage and benefit program for the employees. And this has happened. Democrats, Republicans, makes no difference. It's basically a political strategy that's existed for years and years and years. It's probably human nature. I hate to say that, but it probably is. And what's happened over time is politicians have basically given these benefits to the workers. And I'm not saying that they're not deserved, but they're just not affordable. And the politicians really didn't have to worry about it because, you know, if I say today, hey, Bill, 30 years from now, when you retire, we're going to give you this great pension, and you're going to be so happy with it. Vote for me. Well, Bill's going to say, oh, that's great. I want that kind of a pension. That's wonderful. He votes for you. Well, the bill for that doesn't come due for 20, 30 years from now. As a politician, I'm probably not going to have to worry about running for office at that point, at least maybe not in this locality. I may have moved on. I may be out of politics. I'm interested in today. The bill, we'll worry about that later on. Let some other city commissioner or council member or mayor worry about it. And that's what's happened. I mean, New York City is a great example of this. For many years, New York City municipal employees could basically retire with a full pension with 20 or 25 years of service. And in addition to getting their full pension, they got full health care benefits. So you could have a situation where somebody went to work for the city at age, you know, 21, and at age, you know, 41, 42, 43, 45, they retire. They're receiving full pension benefits plus life insurance, health insurance for life, for themselves and potentially for their family. the expense of that is enormous. And what's happened is many of these localities, simply as the bill's coming due now, they just can't pay it. It's just not possible. There's not enough money to pay it. So what happened in the case of Detroit, this was one of the factors. There were other factors, obviously, in the case of Detroit, but they decided that the only way out was to say, hey, we can't meet these obligations and we can't pay it. Therefore, we're going to file for bankruptcy and we're going to get a bankruptcy court to say we're not obligated anymore. Terrible situation for all sides. You've got people that have come to rely on those payments. They feel that they have a contract. When they worked, they agreed to perform their services in exchange for these benefits. And I agree with that. The problem is somebody at some point should have said, well, wait a minute, this just isn't sustainable. So at this point, we'll have to see what happens, but it's very possible you could find a lot more cities and big cities going the bankruptcy route and these pensions becoming more and more of a problem. All right. Next week, send in your emails. We'll answer some more questions if you have some follow-ups. If you don't agree with me, send me an email. Say, hey, Bruce, you're all wet. You don't know what you're talking about. I think you're wrong. I think you gave some bad advice. Let me know. I'll put you on. I'll read your email. With all that being said, I want you to have a great week. Be well. And keep sending your emails coming in. Till next week, this is Bruce McMenemy with Talking Dollars and Cents.